This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Maria Jose Rodriguez Cadiz. She's Executive Director of the Solace Crisis Treatment Center, and Julie Madrid, who is the Clinical Manager here. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you for having us again.
It's always really good to have you on the air, and we are talking today in celebration of an award that you received from the Life Center Foundation. They have given you a Leadership Grant Award in honor of the great work that you do, so congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the Life Center Foundation.
Yeah, they do great work with organizations that work, I think especially with young people in Santa Fe and in this area. Let's talk about Solace. You haven't been here for, I think, a while, and you used to be called the Rape Crisis Center. There was a rebranding where it became called Solace Crisis Treatment Center. Can you tell us how that has changed how the organization works and sees itself?
The most impactful change has been the one of seeing certain demographics coming through our doors that we didn't see much of in the past. One concrete example of that, Mary Charlotte, is actually our male population. Through my 15 years of experience at Solace, typically it would be anywhere in the world of single digits that we will see as numbers of men coming through our doors, anywhere as far as 27% as soon as the name changes. So one thing that we are extrapolating from the change is that it might have brought down some of the barriers that the name Rape at the Door would have had otherwise for that particular demographic.
What are men coming in for?
As a clinical manager, a lot of what we see is a variety of symptomology. We look at different types of experiences. So they're coming in for some rapes or sexual assault issues, veterans that have post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. But also, as we expanded our services to all types of trauma, we get different types of trauma like car accidents, gun violence issues, death of family members through drug addiction or drug abuse, and different types of violence within the family or household.
All those different kinds of trauma, that's a big expansion from the service of sexual trauma, which was in the past primarily for women. I mean, there were men probably, as you say, who were holding back from entering. Now all these different kinds of trauma, do they all have something in common in terms of the way people are responding, in terms of the kind of help they need?
What we're noticing is that the basis of the symptomology, which is either an acute stress disorder or an anxiety disorder of some kind or post-traumatic stress disorder, are very common across the bounds. So when we look at someone who has a sexual assault, some of the symptomology that they experience can be similar to someone who has a violent incident that they've witnessed or been a part of, or even a car accident. It's the symptoms, when we look at those symptoms, that are limiting their life, limiting them from being present in their life. They might have a severe depression where they don't want to go to work, or their relationships are, you know, going downhill, or their sleep is really horrible. Things like that that we pick up on as across the board. When we went to expand our services, part of expanding it is the work that we were doing with sexual assault clients is more about the symptoms, and we look at PTSD and acute stress as some of those. The symptoms that come up around, say, a car accident or a violent experience of violence in their life are similar symptoms. So we're looking at reducing those symptoms. So for us as therapists, it broadens the scope of what we work on, but the treatment and the way that we work with them are very similar.
It's interesting because I would think that there would be a difference between the kinds of trauma that happen when somebody, either a stranger or a person you know, hurts you versus maybe a car accident or something where it wasn't really anybody's fault and certainly not the intention of perhaps, you know, a loved one, even a boyfriend or husband, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens is that we might think that, but then quite the opposite happens. It's that the similar symptoms is often the person's belief about that experience, or what do they have as far as resiliency factors? And when we talk about resiliency factors, we talk about what do they have in their life that helps them recover quickly from an experience. So if the experience is, say, a car accident, and now they don't have a car, and they don't have a way to get to work, and they don't have a supportive person to get them there, then this whole issue of that car accident can have their life fall apart.
Resiliency seems to mean a couple of different things. There's outer resiliency, like being able to get your hands on another car. Then there's inner resiliency. What are the factors that go into a person's psychological resiliency?
We often look at when people have more resiliency, we're looking at, do they have the ability to, do they have the tools to regulate their emotions? Do they have a supportive environment or family member or friend that can help them get through that? Do they have someone where, say it was a sexual assault or another violent crime, that they're believed and they're heard? And so there's many, many different factors in what creates that resiliency. But when we look at how people responded to them, I talk about building allies. And when we go somewhere and we might say, this sexual assault happened, and then someone has a negative reaction and says things like, you know, oh, well, what were you wearing, or what happened, or what were you drinking? And we ask all those questions. Then I talk to them about, don't pay attention to those people and go find someone who does support you, who doesn't say those negative things to you. And that's the idea where that resiliency comes in, of do we have the opportunity to build allies to strengthen that part within ourselves?
And to translate or to talk into the continuum of services that happen when individuals come to Solace to work on their trauma, the advocacy work that we do with them actually taps into that concept. It is still the best indicator for recovering and for thriving in life, that is the environment reaction when the person amounts the courage to say what has happened to them. And you had an awesome instant. You asked earlier, how could it be similar, a trauma that happened sort of like in a way perceived randomly, as opposed to a trauma that is caused by the person you may like,
yeah,
or in the case of children,
yeah,
by the very same people that should be caring for you. And there, what it does is it disturbs that status quo of a healthy environment. So advocacy services as a continuum while or after trauma treatment potentiates any kind of element that is there in the life of the person that has been impacted, when indeed the harm is being caused by those that they know. Because in the world that we are, Mary Charlotte, the most difficult thing to say about what we know in terms of that our data is that the majority of the harm that is caused to people is caused by those who are well known by them. And that has a peculiar weight in within how a person is going to have to rebuild that surrounding or that support system.
Now, you mentioned advocacy, we're talking about therapy. What's the difference between those two things?
There's a clear different role between a therapist and an advocate. The therapist is going to be the person that is going to both assess the trauma and see if the particular trauma in front of them is one that can be solved by either cognitive behavioral therapy or some sort of a long-term treatment, more long-term. And in the case of advocacy, what the advocate is going to do is become that person in the life of the survivor who is going to allow or help the survivor visualize options in life after the trauma. What does it need to happen to have life looking like it was before the trauma, both on an inner level as well as surrounding or support system level. And it's the idea of having somebody closing their eyes and looking into options. How do those look like? And be prepared and see if they are ready to take or not take certain avenues. For instance, when a person is being victimized by a violent crime, if it is a child or a youth, there is no question that we're going to become immediately a role in their lives to help them navigate the criminal system. In the case of an adult, because they have a right to decide if that is the best for them or not, we help them as advocates to see if indeed they are ready to undertake that journey and what is it going to look like, so they can begin to figure it out if they had the tools that they're going to need. That is one part. The other part is resourcing, we call it, the life of those who have been impacted by the trauma. What kind of services are going to be available to rebuild? Are they needs for shelter or housing, needs for any kind of financial aspect that has been impacted by the trauma or any others? So that I told you in a narrative is called both containing and resourcing. Containing, helping the emotional work, visualizing what are the options after the trauma, and then resourcing the needs of the life that has been impacted by that trauma, that violent crime.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the Solace Crisis Treatment Center. There are a lot of services that you have, as we've been talking about, including for children and young people who've been traumatized or abused in one way or another. First of all, are we talking about, I'm afraid to ask, but pretty high numbers in this area?
In our years, while we do anywhere, we help anywhere from 275 to 300 children that have been allegedly the victims or survivors of crimes committed against them. And those are normally either physical or sexual abuse. And again, the majority of it committed by the people that are supposed to care for them in the first place.
Right.
The moment that there's an allegation of child abuse, there is an entire multidisciplinary team that comes in place to work together. It includes the law enforcement departments in our area, the district attorneys, protective services, sexual assault nurse examiners, and then service providers like trauma treatment, forensic interviewing, and advocacy services. And basically, the child and their caretakers, the caretakers that are not related to the abuse, immediately receive a multidisciplinary approach in order to help on the beginning and end of that allegation of child abuse. For the First Judicial District, which is Los Alamos, Rio Arriba, and Santa Fe, it is the Solace Crisis Treatment Center is the stop for that kind of work. We co-locate services with the Santa Fe Police Department Crimes Against Children Unit, as well as with a program that is a program of St. Vincent's Hospital called the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiners that is both at the hospital and also at Solace. So when a child and their family have to endure this tragedy in life, they have state-of-the-art professionals that are immediately available and start working with them as soon as the allegation is known and stay in within their lives as needed until the conclusion of the case.
This is a whole infrastructure that is relatively recent. I mean, I think when I was a little kid, I'm not sure that kind of thing even existed.
The multidisciplinary team approach that exists in the entire state in nine different locations to do this type of work to protect children from being re-victimized is as old as 20 years in Santa Fe.
Okay.
And then less old in other places in the state of New Mexico, because as the capital city, we begin the work a little earlier. So we celebrated our 20th anniversary in 2014 for that type of work.
Let's talk about prevention. Ideally, we would like to put all of you out of a job where there would be, well, of course, there's always going to be car accidents and things like that, but the kind of domestic abuse, child abuse, sexual abuse that is rampant in our world and maybe always has been, I don't know. But what are the programs that you have? What are the methods to prevent abuse?
I am really glad that you asked that question, because the majority of communities understand that, you know, rape crisis centers, sexual assault service providers, and trauma treatment center, for that matter, are coming to people's lives when the harm is being caused. And that's true, because we want to assess what's been done and hopefully heal and hopefully help in any way that the harm doesn't happen again. There is an incredible amount of work that goes on preventing the harm. And that is not what most of our community members understand for primary prevention. Primary prevention is actually the one type of curriculum and work that can prevent the harm to begin with. Not that we go into the schools and tell kids what good touch and bad touch is, and they tell us, well, that has happened to me, and then we help. That isn't primary prevention as we know it. Primary prevention is a work that actually modifies behavior to prevent that the harm happens to start with. And it is done under the alliance of the Department of Health, and it follows CDC standards, and they're very rigorous. There is about 10 standards that any kind of material or curriculum or program must observe to call themselves primary prevention. And of all of those 10 standards, the one that is actually the indicator of this program being primary prevention versus another program that is not, is the amount of dosage that takes place. Basically, nothing in the world done of in and out of a classroom constitutes primary prevention, no matter how incredible and how valuable the information we give is. In order to modify behavior, we got to go in several times. Mm-hmm. And so the dosage means that students, academic people, and parents, all of them, adults and children and youth, must get the same information and must get it more than once.
Yeah, isn't that funny? The power of repetition. Mm-hmm. All the people who do political advertising know that.
And it's repetition, but it's very wise repetition. It's not just, of course, saying the same thing, but it's actually going at the information from different angles, yet the same information that resides on anti-oppression and social justice work.
Tell us a little bit more about that specifically. Like, what is this information that you're giving people?
The way it looks like is, as we go into the schools, and we do this in the Santa Fe Public School System, and other of our rape crisis center partners in the state do it in their communities, is identifying anything that begins with a language and attitudes that actually supports oppression or discrimination. Because it's more difficult to victimize or violate somebody that you think is unequal to you. Somebody that you can look in the eye becomes another you. And it's more difficult to violate that being than the person that you think you're superior to or of, and or you think they're less than you. So that is the nature of the work that we do in primary prevention. So with students, we identify what is it in their attitudes and their language that supports that oppressive sort of world. And then is let it unfold in dismantling it in different ways. So when you first assess where a classroom is versus where they are after you have delivered the program, there is a change on attitude and beliefs.
And how do you follow up to see if that works?
Through a ton of evaluation. It is very systematically done, and with the technology that we are borrowing from the Department of Health. So these programs are what is called out there in our jargon evidence-based, which means that it's been done somewhere else under the very similar demographics, and is proven to have results. So far, it can be duplicated and expected to have the same outcomes in any other community similar to that one. So we are right now doing what's worked in the nation, across the nation in different places, adopted by the Department of Health, with funding from them, technology from them, and standards from the CDC.
When you talk about that, because this was something I was going to ask actually both of you, there is something about the kind of work that you do, and I know, I've talked to the domestic violence people too, and they say, you know, when you go to a dinner party and people say, what do you do? And they say, I work in domestic violence or I work in trauma treatment. They want to change the subject, and it can be depressing. And I'm sure it can be depressing for you, especially when you're on the ground with clients, to see day after day, week after week, year after year, the kind of abuse that happens. What keeps you going? I mean, I would think the prevention work keeps you going.
Absolutely.
What about you?
Well, as a clinician, I've been here at the agency almost 14 years, and that question comes up quite a bit. We have the ability here at Solace to have a clinical team, and through our clinical team, we staff cases together. We meet quite regularly. We have open door policies that if you have a bad situation or listen to a bad story, that we can go and debrief with each other. But what really is part of it is to notice and to identify how things have changed since I first started here. We used to believe that all young people who have been abused, say 3-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, needed long-term therapy, and they were always going to be damaged for a long, long time after they've experienced a sexual assault or molestation issues. We don't believe that anymore. And so what has changed for us and what makes it really, you know, parts of my job enjoyable is to see young people, 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds who come in who need no therapy, because part of their telling the story and having someone listen to them and have supportive parents who can be there for them and get the services from the advocacy department or get their own therapy within our agency who can be fine. And yeah. So three of the things that we do through our assessment is we provide a assessment to anyone 3 and up who would like one at no cost. We say no cost because it doesn't cost the person or the family member. It does cost someone, and so the money doesn't come out of their pocket. It comes out of other grants or other support that we get.
Right, which is a beautiful thing about how this center works.
Right, so we don't have to haggle about money or how this is going to get paid or if they have Medicaid or not or things like that. So we invite them to come in and get the assessment. And through that assessment, we're looking at 3 different things that will come out. We will invite them to come in for what we call cognitive behavioral short-term therapy, which with kids includes stuff like sand tray and play therapy and art therapy. Sometimes we will refer them out and say, this isn't the best agency. We have other agencies that we connect with that might be better suited. Or that your child is fine, but as a parent, you could use some support, and here's how we're going to offer that. And then the last one is really huge for us to say to a parent of a 3-year-old, and your child is fine. And we give them what we call a clean bill of health. And many times for adults or children that have had a negative experience or a traumatic experience come up, and giving that clean bill of health for us and for them can be just awakening to, wow, my child got checked out, this happened, and they're going to be okay.
The biggest tools that I have in my hands when I go into any audience and the question is asked, what do you do for a living? And I have to tell them what I do. One is to remind us all that in life, some of the most incredible, thriving, magical things we can get comes from very difficult, sometimes even very tragic events. And who we are after any type of tragedy in life is not by any means who we were before. And oftentimes what we forget is that we are stronger. And unfortunately, we can learn by books and being with people, but what we learn from having to overcome difficulties in life goes beyond any other type of experience. That's why our world is full of leaders who are changing the world day in and day out, and they themselves have known tragedy. The second thing is that I have no trouble identifying immediately that as New Mexico is always top of the list on difficulties, is actually really top of the list on resources when it comes to showing up for the courage of survivors.
Well, it's just about time to go, but I want to congratulate you on not only the work you do, but on the leadership grant from the Life Center Foundation, which you recently received, and to allow people to find you, they can go to findsolace.org, and there's also a number that people can call?
Yeah, we have a local number hotline 24/7 every day of the year, and that number is 986-9111. And Mary Charlotte, I just have to personally thank the Life Center Foundation. These people are absolutely outstanding, because every dollar they get goes directly where it belongs. They don't take anything. They're volunteers. They run the entire foundation and volunteer hours, and they are surrounded by some of the most outstanding sponsors in our town, and I would love to name them really quick. The First National Bank of Santa Fe, Los Alamos National Bank, New Mexico Bank and Trust, Morgan Stanley in Albuquerque, Hotel Santa Fe, Engel Law Firm, Agua Fria Properties, and the Owens Gallery. Thank you to all of them, because they do make this community a much better one for all of us.
Maria Jose Rodriguez Cadiz is Executive Director of Solace Crisis Treatment Center. Julie Madrid is Clinical Manager. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.